Jimmy Sullivan is a veteran who's also a private practice clinician. He knows all about trauma and how it applies to veterans specifically. Here he is.
My specialty in my doctoral program is military behavioral health and kind of how I got inspired to it. In 2019, I had a suicide attempt, and that landed me in a VA hospital, with the only outcome of that was 6 different medications and an affinity not to take them. And knowing that what they were diagnosing me with, just simple PTSD, wasn't the end all be all diagnosis for me. And what I come to find out through, you know, some really great people in a couple organizations, that complex PTSD is a more fitting diagnosis for the majority of the military population that is served. And what that gave me was not just a label. It gave me an understanding of what I needed to do, not only to heal spiritually, physically, and emotionally, but it gave me an affinity to not see my friends or family members or others, brothers and sisters, suffer in the way that I did, to where it took 3, 4, 5, 6 years, 12 different medications, to finally come off of all of those medications, to have a great outcome and projection of the way my life went, to now advocating for this population of people and getting the healing that they deserve and the accurate, most up-to-date, evidence-based diagnosis there is out there in the world to see. Because what the United States lacks is an infinity for outside of the medical model thinking, if that makes sense. So I became a therapist in 2020, or I decided to become a therapist in 2020, started to go into school, became an active therapist in 2022. And now I am in private practice. Judith Herman wrote a great book called Trauma and Recovery. What she correlates is that most therapists will never distinguish between the symptomology that they're experiencing and the lived trauma that they have prior to that. They'll just treat the symptomology of what's going on with either the veteran or the first responder or anybody, for that matter, in the theoretical model, unless they catch and see what happened in the trauma that occurred and the symptomology with that, they'll never correlate the two. So you'll see a number of this population of people get misdiagnosed, get put on 5, 6, 7 medications that don't work for them, and they go through this constant rigmarole for years. So if we imagine like the general population of people that experience a traumatic event, it's 1, maybe 2 traumatic events in the course of their lifetime. If we look at the veteran population, they're constantly getting thrown into traumatic events. Even for some, going into basic training could be traumatic for them. So they're going into 3, 4, 5, and on a deployment, you can just imagine that rotating. I know, at least for me in the combat deployment that I was in Afghanistan, we were constantly rotating in and out of missions almost on a daily basis. And if you can just imagine, if we did on average of 100 missions for that 365-day period, 20% of those were traumatic in nature. That's 20 events that this population of people see that is traumatic in nature versus the 1 to 2 that the general population see. If we look at the recruiting standards of how they recruit from a general population of people, I'm going to boldly claim, and I've read this on a number of statistical analysis, that 60% of the people that join the military are escaping some type of background, right? Whether it's poverty, homelessness, misdemeanor crimes, I mean, you name it, they're just trying to better their life, right? So, and that's how we kind of all got into the situation of bonding and this cult of a culture, because we know internally, like the backgrounds that we all came from, we didn't know how to verbalize it, right? We can see the population of people on the front end, but we're just not looking what's on the back end of that population of those kind of like recruiting standards and the population of where we're coming back from. So that's where that complex PTSD comes into play, is that it's just not the moral injury that occurred. It's also the developmental and the formative trauma that happened prior to even enlisting in service.
Yeah. And I do think that's something that I think a lot of us would miss, is making that assumption that the trauma was in the service itself. It sounds like that's short-sighting the experience of veterans, who childhood trauma was probably something you can't ignore, you know, forget to ask those questions.
Yeah. And I think a lot of and good for this, like the therapeutic process is starting to catch up. But I know for my practice, we get an ACEs test. We obviously get the GAD-7, the anxiety and the depression scales, and PHQ-9s, and a dissociative scale is what I'm really interested in. But we also give what's called a PCL-5, which is an identifier to how many PTSD symptoms that you have overall. And that, with the ACEs test, wholeheartedly identifies CPTSD in its entirety. The majority of the population of therapists don't even touch that scale. They just use the PHQ-9 and the GAD-7 as a therapeutic model to see prior to what the gauge their anxiety and depression scales are. I know when I was in community mental health, I wholeheartedly advocated for the ACEs test to be done because it paints a picture of that developmental trauma, right? That's the 10-question test that Kaiser Permanente introduced back in the 1970s, where they introduced this basis of developmental trauma and a scale to use on a national level, right? So if we look at the general population of people, the average population of an ACEs test is a 2. Significantly 3 or higher is a significant number to scale on that. So what I mean by that is, like, if you have a 3 or higher, the outcome scales of other aspects of your life developing, other adverse health experiences happening in your life is significant. You get to a 6 or higher, you're 5,000 times more likely to have autoimmune disorders, cardiovascular disease, depression and anxiety symptoms that are rampant, suicidality. So, and again, if we look at the population of the general people in the world, the average ACEs score is 2. When we look at the average population of a military veteran, the average ACEs score is a 6 in that society. It's inverted. And also, if that's the same as a convicted felon. The great thing about the veteran population is that we have a kind of like a no give up type of attitude. It's like, we will not stop until the mission is complete, you know. And then for the majority of us, and how it translates that to very well, is that we're open to the possibility of that, not only that we're wrong about our own mental health, but we're open to other possibilities of what could possibly help us in our mental health journey, right? I think what the best thing is for the military population, and that what we strive to achieve, is excellence in everything that we do. I think that's what translated well for me coming out of the military, is that, like, I had this, you know, there's this greatness of, like, I can't give up. I don't know where it came from. It could have just came up from childhood, but it was very much instilled in the population that I serve in, is that you get it very much initiated, pseudo-initiated into you in basic training, that this no give up attitude. I love that about the veteran population. If there's one thing I had to know about them, it's like, they will keep coming to therapy. I know that for the veteran population that I serve, the vets are the first responders I see now. They'll keep coming to therapy. They'll keep doing the work. They'll stumble a little bit, fall back, because we know therapy is not a linear process. They'll stumble back, fall into it, and then lean into it a little bit more, fall back into it. And just at one point in time, they'll have what I call a breaking opening, and it'll just all break open for them. And then they'll start healing some more, and it'll go back and forth.
Up next, you'll hear from Christopher Brown, who's a licensed clinical social worker who now owns his own clinical practice. He himself is a wounded Marine combat veteran. You'll hear his insight on the culture and what those of us who aren't veterans need to know and to really understand.
You know, after benefiting so much from my own therapy, getting out of the Marines, 2008, it was after a few combat deployments and getting injured, like, I got a lot of help from an EMDR therapist. And looking at my options using the GI Bill, I decided, like, I'm gonna try to create a career where I can pay that forward. And so that was really what got me into it in the first place.
What was the perception, you, like, if you can go back to 2008, what was the original perception of you, like your peers in the military, would you say, of therapy? Like, were you skeptical?
Yes, very skeptical. I mean, I when I was in the military at the time, this was very true, and I suspect it's probably still true to some degree, maybe different depending on, you know, the command and the area, the base, like, you know, what's the culture like. But at the time, there was a very negative stigma around mental health. And, you know, our assumption was, like, If you say you're having any problems, you know, you're just gonna make your life harder having to deal with paperwork and people who don't understand what you're going through, what you've been through. And, you know, so there was that, but there was also a normalization that, like, everyone around me was on this deployment with me, knows what happened, is probably having sleep issues too, is clearly irritable too. like, you know, there's just, it's normalized and it doesn't feel like there's anything wrong with it when everyone around you is experiencing the same stuff. So it really didn't become really apparent that I had an issue until I was removed from that environment. And now I'm around, you know, friends and family who are like, what the hell happened to you? You're a different person now.
What's the dynamic like with you and your platoon? Once you all come back, like, do you continue everyday conversations? What's that typically look like?
Outside of like the work or training setting?
Yeah.
I don't know if my experience would adequately capture the norm. So I'll start with that. But I mean, from my personal experience, our cultural norm was like, if we're not working, we're probably drinking. And, you know, we're hanging out in the barracks, drinking, playing video games, trying to escape from the reality of like, we live in the middle of the desert and we're going to deploy to another desert in another couple months from now. And that was just the norm. Depending on the group, how long they served together, what they did together. I mean, and this is some, when we talk about the veteran population, we're talking about a multi-generational, you know, multi-socioeconomic status, you know, race, gender orientation, sexual orientation, people that have different reasons for joining. Like, this is a very diverse group, and it's you know, kind of a sample of the rest of the country in a lot of ways. So, you know, depending on your associations and who you bonded with and, you know, maybe how close you live with one another, there is, I think, a lot of folks still make an effort to connect, you know, even if it's once a year on like an anniversary date, you know, let everybody know you're still okay, or, you know, thank the guy that saved your life. You know, things like that to stay in touch and, you know, support each other. And, you know, I think it's probably similar to like a good childhood friend or somebody you spend a lot of time with in college. You know, if you haven't gone a few years interacting with one another, when you meet up again, it's like nothing changed. It's like you're just right back where you left off in terms of like your rapport and your friendship. Like, there's some strong camaraderie that can exist. But I should add that, like, that's not the case for all veterans. Some veterans look at other veterans from a place of, you know, pain or betrayal or distrust because they were hurt by their fellow, you know, peers or comrades while they were in service, whether that be, you know, military sexual trauma or bullying or whatever. So, you know, and that's something that, you know, I assumed as an early therapist in the VA, like, I'm going to immediately have rapport with every vet I talk to. And then I talked to a few who really were not treated well by their peers in the military. And that took a little extra effort to establish rapport and be able to meet them where they're at. And, you know, on the MST, the military sexual trauma thing, I think it's important to note too that this is, when you look at the research of gender and who's affected most, it's actually a 50% like split between, you know, male and female in the military who's affected by military sexual trauma. So that's something I think for therapists to be aware of if they have a veteran come in their office, regardless of, you know, their gender or sexual orientation, it should be something that's, you know, asked about in order to make sure that's, you know, to rule out whether or not that's something that might need some attention during the treatment plan. I gather that information through my intake questionnaire. You know, I use some of the standard assessments like ACEs, PCL5, GAD7, PHQ9. And then through the intake questionnaire and some of the early assessment conversations, that's where I would get more info about MST or the context of their trauma. So, I mean, there currently is still, this has been true since I got out almost 20 years ago now, there's a very high suicide rate among the veteran population. And it's somewhere in the 18 to 22 veterans per day. When I was working at the VA, you know, there was a lot of research around that. And something that I think is just worth noting, a majority of those folks who make up that large number are actually vets who are not actively seeking care with the VA or with probably any providers. So that I think that speaks to the stigma that's probably still existent in a lot of different communities among the veteran population, that mental health is kind of a scary thing. We've had quite a few suicides from the unit that I served in. And so that was something that was obviously just horrific and re-traumatizing to go through after I got out. You know, every time I heard another name, it's like just a moment of coming undone. But I put a lot of thought toward what I was seeing among my peers and what I was kind of learning through interacting with vets in different like volunteer and professional capacities. This is before I became a therapist. But the conclusion I came to at the time, this was probably in 2010, was it seems like all of these guys that I know of are isolated. They are no longer interacting with the rest of us. We assumed they were fine. Like most of them came as a surprise. And so I really latched on to this idea that social isolation is a really big problem that can lead to suicide.
More than any other cultural group, when I think of thwarted belongingness, I think of veterans. Like, I think it would be hard for that not to happen unless you're just staying incredibly connected somehow. Like, but how are you going to do that when you're all going back to your parts of the country or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I thought Facebook and things like that were social media. I thought it was a great tool to maintain those connections. But, you know, as we've discovered, it's still just surface level. There's not a lot of depth to the connection that can happen there. And there are like nonprofits that will make an effort to help pay for like reunions for units to come back together and kind of reestablish those connections and those relationships. And there are actually tens of thousands of small nonprofits around the country that do like really good local work, you know, having a place or an activity. You know, there's surfing groups, music groups. The nonprofit I built and still am on the board for, we've got a farm that we use to say, hey, come out here and let's work together and kind of, you know, talk about things as we're weeding the carrots or, you know, pulling weeds, and, you know, have that informal peer support opportunity. There are others that are doing like natural disaster work where they have vets come out together and help clean up a community. I mean, there's all sorts of things like that that I think are all, whether it's intentional or not, they're all trying to solve that problem. But, you know, if a therapist is listening to this and has a vet on their caseload, it might be worth, you know, typing in your local city and, you know, veteran nonprofit and see what's out there if you're not aware of them already, because those might be good, you know, not necessarily clinical referral places, but place that you could encourage vets to check out and see if it's something that helps them reestablish some sense of community and belonging again.
Have you found in just your personal observations that veterans tend to gravitate to other veterans, like within their community, even if they kind of weren't part of their experience?
That's a kind of a mixed bag. I think it's probably safe to say majority of vets who had a reasonably good experience and didn't feel betrayed by their peers while they served, it's probably more of the they feel happy to just connect with another vet who was in the armed forces. And I would think it's okay to say that a reasonable and probably a majority of vets are happy to just connect with other vets. I mean, there is going to be a difference in the level or the depth of the connection for a lot of people. I think it's probably easier to feel a deeper connection with someone who knows exactly what you did, whether they did it in the same unit or just the same area a couple of years later. I felt just as strong of a connection with infantry guys who served in Vietnam as I have with guys who served in Iraq or Afghanistan. But I also appreciate being able to chat with any veteran that did anything in the military, because there's always an interesting, you know, story or thing to learn from them. There's varying degrees of like depth that I think is experienced in those connections, but I think in large part they're helpful.
How do you navigate as a therapist, like when a person's service really isn't central, you know, like to what their therapeutic goals are? I guess I'm curious if, you know, I have a veteran who's coming in who's saying, like, what I'm struggling with is a divorce or, you know, something just happened. Mm-hmm. Like, do I push them to talk about how their service might be connected? Or do I take that at face value and say, like, you don't want to talk about your service, we don't have to talk about it. You know, like, that's not what you're here for.
First, I think it depends on the rapport. I think a lot of our work depends on the level of rapport we have established. But with something like this, you know, if the rapport isn't super strong yet, you might, you know, allow that to be okay for now, while maybe sort of planting a seed that perhaps there's more behind that will need our attention later. But if you've got good a rapport established and you've done a thorough history with them, they know that you know all of these different areas of their lives, what they experienced in the military, what they experienced before the military. You know, if you, I think, I guess after saying that out loud, it also comes down to doing a really thorough history with them. Because if you have, then hopefully this, you know, having that conversation is easier. It's like, well, yeah, I hear you that this thing is going on with your spouse, but I can't help but wonder whether or not this thing that happened in the military, where, you know, you must have been feeling completely helpless or powerless in that moment, probably had an effect on your nervous system. And I wonder if these interactions you're having with your spouse are because that's being re-triggered again under the surface. And if that's the case, then maybe we can still spend some time, you know, exploring different approaches to how you might communicate in the present. But these struggles you're having in the present might be more rooted in the stuff over here in the past. And, you know, I can't think of an example of someone who is like, you know, that's bullshit, what are you talking about? So people usually get what you're saying when you frame it this way. Exploring reasons for joining the service in the first place, I think, is helpful. You know, there seems to be a few key reasons that folks will join the military. You know, there may be a family kind of history, generational legacy that they're following, uncle, dad, grandparent, you know, someone at mom, somebody else served in the military, so they're going to do it too. There's also a really common theme of, you know, I see what my environment looks like now that I'm out of high school. I can make my own decisions, and this doesn't seem like an environment I want to spend much more time in. I want to get out of here, and the military looks like a great option for that. I can, you know, get trained in a skill. I might be able to have, you know, job skills for the future. And, you know, that, I guess this is kind of leading into the next one, which is access to benefits. You know, after you serve your time in the military, having access to the GI Bill to get a college education paid for is a really great opportunity for a lot of people. Those are some of the more common reasons. I think a lot of times veterans appreciate being able to share parts of their story. And, you know, this theme that I've touched on a couple times of developing a thorough history, in the process of doing that and asking these more, you know, provoking questions to really learn more about where they were at, it's a way of establishing rapport too. I mean, the intake process doesn't have to be this like rigid thing that we check that box and we move on. And it can actually be a really useful rapport establishing tool. So if folks aren't viewing it that way, I would guess I would challenge them to try to do that and see how it goes. There is one more thing, and this is kind of silly, but I think matters. You know, there's this common phrase that veterans hear all the time, thank you for your service. And I know that most people that I've heard it from, they're saying it from a genuine place, like, you know, but it also can feel to a lot of vets just like a bumper sticker, like, this is what I'm supposed to say when you tell me you're a veteran. So it doesn't always feel like something we want to hear. But I can't remember where I heard it. There was this suggestion to try replacing that phrase with a thank you for your sacrifice, because it acknowledges, like, this is a group of people that sacrificed anywhere from 3 or 4 years to 20 years or more of their lives, and, you know, their families too, they sacrificed right along with them to, you know, sign the dotted line, do whatever the military asks them to do, go wherever they ask them to go. I mean, there is sacrifice that comes with that. And so it can feel like a more meaningful phrase. There is a caveat to that. If the person lost someone overseas, they may respond with, like, well, I didn't sacrifice anything. My guy over here did. But that still is a deeper interaction than what might happen with the bumper sticker phrase.
In some cases, veterans may be weary of outsiders, including clinicians who don't understand military life. So for those of us who don't have this type of experience or insight, making an effort to develop cultural competence, even in just ways like understanding military-informed language, like rank structures, can go a long way in helping to build trust. Also, understanding the values that veterans hold can be big. Values like discipline and loyalty and stoicism and self-sacrifice. And then, like Jimmy talked about, a mission-first mentality. Those values can influence how veterans communicate and express emotions and seek help. My hope is that as a field, we can truly honor our veterans by being culturally sensitive and informed in the ways that we can, that it can be our small way of showing true appreciation for their sacrifice.